This car is the most honest car you ever see.
It's been a dream ever since I've had it.
The first time I heard that engine screaming, I thought, I gotta have one of those.
For me, the cars have personality.
What's great about a BMW Classic is the community that surrounds it.
When you listen to that, that's why we're here.
Welcome to Classic Heart, the BMW Group Classic Podcast. My name is JP, and I'm incredibly happy that Tim Burton, aka Schmee150, has time to join us today, because this gentleman is traveling the world to create wonderful content about everything that has two or four wheels or even flies. We're very happy that Tim took the time to join us today. Welcome, Tim.
Thank you very much. Hello, it's wonderful to be here chatting with you. Been looking forward to it.
Thank you very much. That's very kind. And I can say absolutely in return, Tim, I think it's good if I address you like Tim, right?
Yeah, for sure. For sure.
Perfect. Tim, where are you today? Because I think you're barely at home, aren't you?
You've actually caught me on a day when I am. I'm at my base in England, just outside of London.
Yeah.
The Schmuseum, which is where I keep my cars, film a lot of my videos. But literally, yes, after here, hopping straight on a plane onto the next stop.
Yeah, I mean, that must be incredible. I thought I travel a lot. But when we met recently in Marbella at the Costa del Sol Concorso de Elegancia, I just was astounded to learn where are you going and how many days a year you're away from home. So how do you cope with all that traveling?
I'm super lucky that being able to be a content creator and shooting videos mixes a bunch of my different passions together, from the cars, the obvious one, to travel, to technology, you know, cameras, different social media networks. And I still have a buzz. You know, I've been doing videos on YouTube for basically every day for 14 years now, and still enjoy it just as much as before, because there's so much to see out there. You know, the world is a huge place. There's always something new to find out, somebody new to meet, somewhere, something new to experience, you know, car-wise or destination-wise.
So true. But let's jump into cars, because I'm just eager to ask you that question. Your second car, and correct me if I'm wrong, but I hope we did the research right. Your second car, after owning a Renault Clio Dynamique, yep, was a white E82 1-Series 123D coupe.
Absolutely. Technically, yes. My third car, because okay, I had lived in New Zealand for a bit and I had bought an old Subaru in New Zealand.
Okay, no, that doesn't count. That's too far away. That's the 5,000 mile range. So that doesn't count.
And it was only like a £700 car. So
perfect car. I mean, Subarus are fantastic.
And do you know what? Some of the most fun motoring I've ever had in my life.
Yeah,
just
I agree.
Skinny tires, four-wheel drive in the snow. Yes. Amazing.
Amazing. Man, speaking about a proud Forester owner, so an old one. But anyway, Subaru, I really get that. That's fantastic. Okay, let's say the third car or two and a half car. Why did you choose that model? I think it was back in 2008. So this was a model year 2008, if I remember correctly. So why did you choose that car? Why a BMW 1 Series?
You know, when the first 1 Series had launched, you know, the original hatchback.
Yeah.
I was kind of, my dad had always been a BMW guy. He's always had
very
nice
good man.
BMW. No, yeah, absolutely. You know, perhaps I should touch on that topic first. You know, when I was younger, we always had a 5 Series in the family. The first car I ever moved around our driveway, I should stress, was my dad's E46 M3. So
nice.
You know, I started in a good place. So I guess for me, you know, I'd always been enthusiastic for the BMW range, and you know, when you're a teenager, you're trying to work out what you might be able to stretch into. And I was doing some small time trading online around my school work as a teenager. So
really,
I was being optimistic about what car I might be able to get. And I was you know, like a 116i, just a BMW. That was kind of my goal. You know, 16-year-old Tim was kind of, I want a 116i, and I was on the BMW website every 5 seconds trying to work out, you know, in the early days of configurators, trying to figure what color to go for, and you know, all of that kind of stuff. And at the end of the day, things go in the way they should, and it's kind of a little bit out of range. So that's why the Renault Clio came in. It was that. And people always ask me now, what should I get as my first car? And I'm like, your first car, something's going to go wrong at some point. Just something that you're not too stressed about. Save up for something a little bit later. And my dad successfully convinced me of that. So fast forward a couple of years, and yeah, I've got my first 3 or 4 years of driving under my belt.
And obviously in the meantime, the E82 had launched the coupe format. Yeah. And I thought it was awesome. You know, the baby BMW had grown up. It had become a, it became a proper car. You know, it was really, having often had, like I said, always basically a 5 Series saloon and a 3 Series coupe in the family. When that launched, I was completely sold on it. And at the time, I already loved the idea of traveling around the continent. You know, I had spent a fair bit of time when I was 19. I had spent 6 months living in France. I'd spent a fair bit of time on the road traveling. You know, as soon as I turned 18, because in the UK you can drive from 17, but you have to be obviously 18 for even France, etc.
Yeah.
So as soon as I had turned 18, a friend and I jumped in his car and did a road trip all the way across. You know, we went from London to Amsterdam to Berlin to Prague, back via Munich, and then to Paris and then home. So I always had that sense of travel. And so I opted for the 123D. The 123D was a funny car in the position. You had this fantastic 2-litre turbo diesel engine pushing out just over 200 horsepower, incredible efficiency. But most people were opting for the 120D.
True.
And would perhaps go for the M Sport kit, you know, the upgraded visuals. And I did a test drive back to back, you know, between the two at my dealer, and I was completely sold on it. I thought it was a wonderful car to drive, and I had lots of plans of doing big miles around the continent. And obviously, fuel prices at the time, diesel was significantly beneficial. And as it happens, that was the first car I ever filmed on my, or uploaded a video of on my YouTube channel. It was really a kind of eye-opener to even more of the car world. You know, my first car, my Clio, like for everyone, had been the first time traveling, the first time going to friends' places, the first time you have that freedom. And I think the 1 Series was really, you know, I thought I was the coolest kid in town with my 123D.
I'm sure you were, especially as it was white, wasn't it?
Yeah, and that's quite a funny one now, you know.
It is.
Ordering an Alpine white car back in 2008, the dealer was like, are you sure? My parents were like, are you sure? Because white cars weren't really the thing, especially not in the UK. You know, red, sure, obviously silver, black, silver and black are the main options people go for. But it hadn't yet become the trendy thing that over the following years it really did. And I tell you what, when I sold the car a few years later, that worked very much in my favor because it went for a very high price very quickly.
I mean, let's do a little excursus, because I think that if you look at the Schmuseum and all your cars, I mean, white is not the predominant color, I would say. No. It's rather like vivid colors. So why do you choose these? I mean, with the Alpine white, all done right, because you were before the trend, exactly jumped on, sold it when the trend was there for white cars. But how do you choose your colors?
I actually now try and choose colors just for variety. It's funny having had, as you say, a white car, but I guess my parents had always had silver cars or fairly safe cars. Some of the BMWs had been red. And actually a couple of months before I got my 123D, my dad actually picked up a Melbourne red E92 M3. So
good
color. Again, you know, going from M3 in the parents' garage to me popping home with my 1 Series again, I felt like I was the cool kid. you know the feeling. We've all been there. I've obviously had this color explosion now. For those who know my car collection, it's very bright. Everything from pinks to lime greens to you name it. I just like color. We're completely obsessed with color, and I like to not have any two cars in the same color. I actually went backwards and forwards because we'll probably talk more about it in a moment, but I've recently bought a 1M, 1 Series M Coupe, and I bought it in Valencia orange, which of course was the signature color for the car. I did go backwards and forwards about whether I should buy an Alpine white one as a tribute to the original 123D. But no, I need color in my life.
But you see this Schmi 150, who is really like around supercars, the rarest cars on planet Earth, largest supercar collections, yourself have a colorful collection. But then you meet, and I mean, I saw this in Marbella, you're so open to everyone, like really no attitude, nothing. And you don't come along as someone who would like to have like the entree, as we say in French, like with a colorful car, here I come. And yet you love it. But is there a connection between that two? Or is it really like, okay, that's the negative side I have to take if I love colors?
I'm trying to get my own thoughts on that one. The, you know, for sure, especially when you're talking supercars,
yeah,
colors do generate reaction in both directions.
Totally.
You know, if you're driving in a Lamborghini in a very bright Larry color,
yeah,
you're going to have people have a preconception about who the driver is before you get out of the car.
Definitely.
There's no question about it. Versus, you know, driving a very smart car in a black or silver or a nice pearlescent dark color, for example, a green or a red or something.
Yeah.
So there's certainly an element of that. I'm sure I'm partly driven towards colors by the social media side of things, mm-hmm. standing out in pictures and thumbnails. I'm sure there's an element of that. But even if we go back prior to it being my job or doing it in any serious capacity, the car I replaced my 123D with was the new Audi S5 Cabriolet at the time.
Mm-hmm.
And I had ordered that in a custom color. I'd ordered mm-hmm. it in a color not available for the car. And I've always been interested in different colors. Yeah. And even after that, my next upgrade was a bit of a big step up into an Aston Martin Vantage Roadster, which I had, and I still actually have that car today in a metallic light blue. So I've always liked things that look smart, look a little bit different, make the car a little bit more unique. You know, my attention's always been grabbed by cars that stand out. And if you look at new cars now and the different options customers have, it's quite frankly amazing. And then once you start in the supercar territory, making completely bespoke liveries and options and accent colors, you see some quite sometimes overkill, but sometimes quite fantastic cars coming through. So for sure, you know, there's an element of the car standing out, whether it's at an event or something like that. But for me, you know, I'm sat here, we're talking from the garage and I'm looking out, and I love looking out over the cars and seeing all of the color. You know, it's to me, it's just so vivid and so exciting.
I mean, we have to give a little bit of background for those who aren't familiar with this museum. So Tim's office is on the first floor. From his desk, where he is currently sitting, he looks through the glass front down into the hall where all his wonderful cars are parked. And what you see is a color explosion. Believe me, it is a color explosion that makes you very, very smile when you look at it. And that colors are very important to you, Tim. Showed one incident that we had when we looked at one specific car at the Costa del Sol Concours, where we both had the pleasure to be earlier this month. Do you know which car I'm referring to?
Of course, I remember which car you're referring to. Yeah. How could I possibly forget? The Sian Roadster. You know, when it comes to cars like that, they're all special. You know, the Sian is Lamborghini's. It was the first hybrid car they had made, 63 coupes, 19 roadsters. You know, it's such a rare thing. And it's become a recent trend that you might have seen where customers have been opting with cars to have a paint fade. So they tend to fade from one color at the front through to another car at the back, sometimes more gradually, sometimes fairly abruptly around the door sections. But this has become a thing. You know, at the first it was red to black or blue to black, you know, fairly safe, single color. And then people have started going green to purple, and it started to get a little bit crazy. And in fact, I actually, a couple of years ago, I drove a Sian coupe that was from white through pink to purple with accents in bright colors as well.
Yeah.
And that was your eyes had to really stop and just take that in for a moment, because
that overflow, was color overflow.
Yeah. Even just hearing me say that, you're probably like, how does that work? Anyway, yes, we should
LSD
get back
on wheels, I would say.
Yeah, the one we saw in Spain. What was really interesting to me about that was it did something I hadn't seen on a production car that a customer had spec'd before, which it actually faded from the top to the bottom. So it went from this gray paint at the top down towards black at the bottom, all around the car. So you had that fade around the bumper, across the doors, around the lower front nose. And what that created, which I actually really quite liked, because I've always had this problem with a paint fade car, that if you look at it from the front, it's a red car, and from the back, it's a black car. And it's almost like disjointed. It kind of, to me, kills the design a bit, because you're looking at a base that the designer has created to be coherent, you know, to make sense all around.
and you're almost getting two totally different takes, which arguably in one sense is cool, but in another sense feels like two different cars. And that turns me off it a little bit. But this fade down from the top to the bottom gave me that option for some extreme color examples, but retained that feeling that it's the one car.
Speaking about colors of the cars in your own collection, I would like to speak about the Valencia Orange 1M that you have bought recently. And looking back in your BMW history, was that something you dreamed of in the sense of making progression in your BMW cars?
I guess like anybody, you know, you're always dreaming of what's next, right? You're always dreaming of the big one. And while I had moved on from my 123D by the time the 1M came out, at the time I wasn't spoiled to be in the position to have more than one car. So it was very much a case of, you know, how cool would it be to have one of those? And this particular car came up from a friend who has a specialist who typically is dealing with i3s. And it's...
I like that idea already, that someone is specialized in i3s, because I'm a big fan of the i3.
He sold absolutely hundreds of them, 500 or so. Yeah, really, really cool. And he had picked up this car. And what was so unusual about this particular 1M is that for the first 10 years of its life, it's had one single owner who's driven it a lot. It had 93,000 miles, so about 150,000 kilometers.
Wow.
With one owner.
That's a lot. Yeah, that's crazy.
Full official main dealer routine servicing, always by the book, on the book. Lots of parts had been upgraded. In fact, I kind of bought it a little bit blind because the price was so good. You know, my friend gave me a good price on it, and it was, what's the worst that can happen? You know, which is bad logic, by the way. Do not normally use that logic. Okay. Anyway, when I took this car...
Don't try this at home. Let's give a warning. Don't try this for all American users. Don't try this at home.
Yeah, don't buy blind and just hope it's going to be good. When we popped it up onto a lift to have it to start digging in and having a look, it was like, oh, this is actually good. This is like, there's not really a whole lot that needs to be done with this. Now, it was a little bit of a funny choice for me in one sense, though, because it's the only car I own of the 20-odd cars I currently have in the launch color for that car. And I tend to avoid launch colors because I like it to be a bit unique.
Yes.
There's one other car I have, which you could only have in one color, a special limited edition Focus RS. And even with that, for example, I actually wrapped the roof matte black just to make it a little bit different, you know, just add my twist to it. So the 1M in you know, the original communications color, we could call it the Valencia Orange. It works because it's the only car I have in that color, and I think it always looked so good in that color. You know, it was a great choice. And
it looks like an elegant bronze. It has like this bronzy element in it, but it doesn't look like shiny bronzy like you have like if foiled. So I think the color works very well, especially on a compact car.
Yes,
it really does a good job.
And my plan with it is to not do something silly like make massive horsepower or anything like that. I just want to do some small changes, maybe some brakes, maybe some suspension. You know, I love driving at the Nürburgring. I take pretty much every car I have to the Nordschleife to do some laps at some point. So that's what certainly on the cards. And, you know, it's always a fun voyage to depart from here to head over, take a crossing over the English Channel, drive over to Germany. You know, at some point I'd love to also get it back to its hometown, bring it back to Bavaria.
I mean, I think we will wait for you. So let's make it happening. Let's make it as a young timer. Sorry, but this is a very German word. Young timer is, I think it's not widely used in the English.
Obviously spending time in the automotive industry, I know exactly what you mean by it. But exactly. it's not a young classic. Yes. We would tend to call it a modern classic, probably.
Modern classic, yeah.
Yeah, there was actually a fantastic event. You know, there's a Wanna M registry group of guys looking after, you know, tracking where the cars are. And there are over 300 odd members who are already part of the club. And they actually had, I think it was the best part of 100 1Ms for a gathering at the Nürburgring GP track very recently. Mega. The photos are awesome. It's so cool. And it was during Monterey Car Week. So I was obviously at Pebble Beach at the concourse and hadn't yet made it home. So I couldn't attend. And I was looking at these pictures, hugely envious, because I'd have loved to have been part of that, you know, to be at that event.
And you mentioned the 1M registry. And yet again, that shows how specific the car world can be. I mean, how fragmented actually the car world is. So you can have a 1 Series Owners Club. You can have a BMW 1 Series Diesel Owners Club only. Or there's something like the 1M Club and Register. So I think it shows how beautiful and how individual the automotive world can be, that you find a home to share your love for a specific make and model in the car world. You find like-minded people and you can create a club out of it.
People, especially with a car like this, people are proud of it. You know, it's such a great car and it's such a big part of the history. And, you know, we talk about the 1M as the pinnacle of the 1 Series of, in terms of 1 Series coupes. Of course, afterwards came the 2 Series.
Of course.
So it literally was the end of the 1 Series coupe. And, you know, I obviously been lucky to spend a fair bit of time around different 2 Series models over the years. My dad has a previous generation M2 competition and a new M2 on the way. So there'll be plenty to come with that as well. The M cars have definitely stayed in his blood. I don't think he's driven my 1M yet, though. At this point,
I mean, that would be a nice video. But
I should probably force him to get behind the wheel at some point.
Yeah, maybe you switch cars. You take the M2 competition, and he takes that one to the Nürburgring, and then you see who wins.
he actually comes by quite often and just borrows a car for a bit, which is really good fun. Yeah, I mean, I'm only about half an hour from where my parents live, so it's quite fun to, you know, to have this opportunity. Whether it's, you know, taking a Ferrari for a bit or my Lotus Emira, he's borrowed a fair bit as well. Yeah. Yeah, I think the 1M will be up next.
So I could imagine you sneaking into the living room saying, you know, do you think I can borrow the M3 for a drive? And now it comes like he plays the reverse card for every time I let you drive that car. So I want to have like now something from your garage. But, you know, you buy also quite a lot of pre-owned cars, actually, yeah?
I have a couple. To be honest, I focus more because I like the experience on buying new cars. I really enjoy, and it's strange to say, I enjoy waiting for the car to arrive. I enjoy the motions. I enjoy it being revealed, driving one for the first time, choosing the options, getting the experience to collect the new car. I absolutely love choosing the smallest of details and how it's going to look. Of course, I have in my collection a couple of cars that I've bought secondhand, the 1M, a Clio V6, I have an SLS Black Series, my V8 Vantage Roadster, and I've tended with the cars actually that I have bought to change something on them to make them personal.
Sure.
Whether that's as extreme as a complete respray, changing the body color, or whether it's doing some underpinnings. And I know the world of collectors, you know, when you say you're respraying a limited 1 of 350 car, people, you just see their faces drop. Yes. Like, why would you do that? But we're in a different time. And I actually think this is a really interesting topic. You know, how many special 60s cars have had a change of color in their lifetimes? It becomes almost unimportant because by the time a car's that age, you can always restore it back to how it was if you want.
Yes, true.
For sure, you know, a low mileage, perfect condition car that's never been touched in any form is always going to hold a little bit more value because of its originality. You know, you can't remake that.
Yes.
But time does its thing to cars, right? They need work eventually anyway.
Being a member of different juries for Concours events taught me something very important, and that helped me to understand, to differentiate two things. One is keeping a car in original state, like it was delivered, or in period trim and color, is one thing. But you have to maintain it like that. The opposite is just completely abandon the car and leave it like it is. Don't take care of it. Don't do necessarily repairs that help to preserve the original state, is a completely different thing. So I'm more on the side of that you have to take care of something, but keep it original.
I'm curious on your thoughts on a topic. In recent years, we've seen the rapid growth of foiling cars, you know, vinyl wraps, changing colors, and simultaneously manufacturers across the entire board offering so many different options than before. So yeah. When you look now at cars from 10 to 20 years ago, which were normally only offered in a handful of colors.
Yeah.
You know, a lot of special models, like I mentioned for the 1M, you could only have three colors on the 1M, orange, yes. white, or black. People now, consumers now have the mentality that they want to choose their specification. They want to be able to have what they would like for that car. We're very lucky to be able to have that freedom and those options. Yes. Do you think that as time goes by and, you know, a generational shift, people will feel perhaps less specific about the originality because they would prefer to have it their way? Or do you think that there will always be a really important requirement for the originality?
It's an amazing question. Normally, I don't accept being asked questions, but I'd like to answer that one. No, just joking. It's a conversation. It's not that me just pulling out a question.
No, yeah, of course.
It's a very interesting topic, and I think it's a very well-phrased question. So in my personal opinion, I would say it become obsolete. Originality will become obsolete. So it will not be that important anymore because the individualism is overruling everything that has something to do with tradition and keeping things as they are. I think we will come to a phase where you can, and we saw this already, we come to a phase when, you know, when BMW present the car which you, where you just switch the color change. I mean, it's not mm-hmm. there yet because the petrol filler cap and stuff like this, that doesn't work in that sense, but it will come. So I think originality in that sense is not existing anymore because everything will change within seconds. So I don't think that originality in terms of this will be a broad thing. It will always be like a niche, mm-hmm, right?
For sure.
But I think it will change. But what's your opinion about that?
You know, even in 50 years time, for sure, looking at cars from what would be 100 years old at the time, there will certainly be a collectible niche and a desire for concourse cars that are completely perfect as they were.
Yeah.
But similarly, when your car that is autonomously driving you down the street, you can change the color at the press of the button.
Yeah.
It's a very different mindset to what we have now. And one particular example I think about in this context is Ferrari. Ferrari mm-hmm. are traditionally red, Rosso Corsa. If you have a new limited edition Ferrari model, the vast majority will typically be Rosso Corsa.
Yeah.
Whereas the latest special edition, the 812 Competizione and Competizione Aperta, very few of them are Rosso Corsa. Very few. If you search around for pictures, the vast majority are in unusual, non-typical Ferrari color schemes. And I think that summarizes this shift that we have at the moment. And arguably, I think down the line, perhaps for collectors, for example, who would like all of the Rosso Corsa Ferraris, I think there will actually be a potentially increased demand for an original Rosso Corsa one, ironically, because right now everyone is doing individual colors.
Yeah.
But I find it fascinating as a shift.
Yeah. Tim, allow us one last question because you need to catch a plane. Let's speak about the Schmuseum. This is the name of your car collection, but is it actually a museum you can visit, which is open to the public?
Sadly, it's not a public venue because, of course, we're creating content basically every day. And at the end of the day, I don't have the facility to set up at this time. Maybe in the future. I've kind of played a lot with the Schme thing. Mm-hmm. It's branding. And at the end of the day, I have basically 10 full-time people working with me to create all the content we create. So over the years, the audience actually are responsible for creating the terms.
Yeah.
But we've had, my cars are nicknamed the Schmemobiles. When we do a meet and greet, you know, like a fan gathering, they became called Schmeetings. I know it's a bit overkill. I apologize for people who
I love it
listening and kind of like, why on earth would you do that? And then when I was growing my car collection, you know, obviously at the time I started, I had just my one series. Over time, it went to two cars, to three cars, to four, five, six, seven, you know, then it chilled a little bit for a while. And then it quickly got to 10 or 11. And then it was kind of, I actually need somewhere to put all of these now.
Yeah.
And in addition to that, I'd love to have somewhere quiet to be able to create my content. So for a long time, I was looking for what would that place be like. And through my videos, I've been fortunate to visit a lot of private collectors around the world. some stunning places from famous locations like a tour around Jay Leno's garage with Jay to totally unseen private garages in Mexico or Japan, you know, stuff that's never been anywhere. Yeah. And everywhere that I've been along the way, I've taken some inspiration, tried to be like thinking, how would I do this? So I'd been looking for a location and the audience, like I say, suggested to call it the Shmuseum. You know, that name came from them. And I found this barn just outside of London, which at the time was open at the back. It had been a milking parlor. So it was open to the collecting yard out the back. There was no concrete floor. It was just a dirt floor inside. You know, it was completely an active farm building. And I was standing there thinking, we could probably do something cool with this. And it was relatively a good price compared to like an industrial unit and came with a whole further degree of privacy because I wouldn't be next door to, you know, somewhere where there's deliveries coming in and out every day.
Yeah, sure.
It took 6 months to make it inhabitable. And by that, I mean a concrete floor, a shutter door, all the security stuff, you know, the bollards, cameras, alarms, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. That took 6 months. Yeah. And by the end of that, when I finally showed it online, it still looked pretty scruffy. And I was like, oh, I'm tired already.
We have to say that the outcome is absolutely fantastic. And it looks all pretty, pretty right, I have to say. Tim, we need to leave you heading off to the airport. And thank you very much for joining us today. It was, as usual, a big time fun, lots of laughter, which I always prefer in combination with a deep car talk. And specifically, I love that we had also an edition where we spoke a lot about BMW. And so I'm very, very happy that you joined us and took the time. Thank you so much for this.
It's been an absolute pleasure. Thank you so much for having me to join. And I look forward to catching up again soon.
Absolutely. And of course, if you liked this kind of things we're doing here, if you like our little podcast, Classic Heart, please do us a favor and put us on subscription. And if you want to do us an extra favor, leave us a high rating that also others who might search for a topic have the chance to find us as well. And of course, this podcast would not have been happening without a lot of people in the background. Just to mention a few is Alex and Marcus from Scenario Studio in Munich, Federica von Königswald, who is helping us with all the details in not talking too much nonsense with is actually my department normally. And we have Robin from Shot One who helps out also a lot. So all the team would like to thank you all for joining us today. Thank you very much.